Well, in Kansas, a high school science teacher was suspended for allowing students to use the same instrument to draw blood from their fingers as part of a class project. This is a no-no. About 50 juniors and seniors in two science classes at the Salina High School South use the same lancet or small pin to prick their fingers. The science teacher suspended with pay during an investigation. Synthetic biology, what is it? We'll find out from Charles Usman in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Charles Usman is a senior fellow at the Institute for Global Futures, serves with the management team of Fourth Venture. He's an active participant with the Millennium Project for Global Future Studies and Research of the American Council for the United Nations University. Charles has more than 25 years' experience in the fields of electronics, material science, computing, artificial intelligence, including 8 years at Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory at the University of California, Berkeley, and the Los Alamos National Laboratory. Charles, I'm told a little bird tells me you're going to be at the Richard Hoagland's Joshua Tree Conference in a few weeks.
Your crystal ball is quite perceptive, indeed.
So. Good. What's your role there? What are you going to speak on?
I'm not sure precisely what I'm going to speak on. I'm actually, like a volunteer, I'm helping out with some of the activities there, but we'll be having some discussion.
Knowing Richard, he will summon you to the stage and get you to say something.
I'm sure that'll happen, and I welcome the opportunity.
You know, when I was talking with producer Lisa about a topic, and she said, hey, did you ever do anything on synthetic biology? I said, what? And she said, you got to talk to Charles about this. And, of course, you've been on the program before, but, you know, and I started doing a lot of heavy research in this, but I want to hear it from the horse's mouth. Synthetic biology, what is that?
Or the organism of your choice's mouth, indeed so. Well, in a very simple way, and it's actually a very complicated topic, but the simplest sort of Occam's razor description I would offer at this moment is it comes in two kind of separate camps, but they're very tightly connected. One camp says that it's the ability to, in a sense, decompose or select certain sections or components of living things, and then recombine them to make an entirely new kind of organism. That's one area. But then there's the more radical area, which is really where the real breakthroughs are, and I think that's kind of where we might be focusing tonight, is in the ability to actually construct an organism from scratch. I mean, literally build a living thing from bits of chemistry and various proteins.
We become God, Charles, don't we?
Well, yes. I mean, I know this is, I mean, we're going to be controversial going out of the gate. I guess we're going to start there.
Uh-huh.
So that could be a definition, yeah. True.
Now, you know, when you talk about synthetic biology, also, are you talking about the ability to make blood in things like that?
As a matter of fact, it's funny you should bring that up because that is one of the sort of current hot sort of commercial items. I mean, there's several companies doing this at the Institute for Global Futures. That's one of the clients that we worked with, actually. That's precisely what they got their patents on, was a form of synthetic blood. But there's several different variations of that theme as we speak.
Does synthetic blood look like real blood?
You know, I've never seen the actual product that this particular company has produced, although I've seen lots of sort of technical schematics and written, you know, seen lots of patents written about that sort of thing. But I've never, like, seen an actual vial of the stuff, so I'm not sure if it's, like, you know, red and thick. But I'm
as opposed to coming out white or something like that.
Or some other strain, you know, green or something. Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, clearly, if it has hemoglobin processing capacity, I would guess it's going to be red just because of that.
Well, that's true, too. But, you know, when you hear the word synthetic, you believe that everything is being manufactured. Is that necessarily the case?
Well, this is where it gets a little fuzzy. So, and by the way, I want to publicly thank your web producer, your webmaster, Sean. He did a great job. He was extremely patient, and I had to pick out of several hundred slides the handful that I thought might be the best to sort of represent this topic. And he very patiently sort of let me fumble around and pick the right ones, and he did a great job. So
great.
Thank you very much.
And we will be getting to them throughout the night. And
sure.
Everybody get to the coasttocoastam.com website because Charles has given us 11 slides that we have illustrated, and we'll go through them a little bit later, and you can explain what they are. But
sure.
But to me, synthetic does mean artificial.
Yeah, it does so. And so it's a great zone, but let me see if I can kind of back into it a little bit
right,
to kind of give a linear progression. If you go backwards in time a handful of years, maybe it would start with somebody named Craig Venter, who's very famous for having developed the Human Genome Project on the private side. And, of course, his sort of arch rival at the time was Francis Collins. But as you may recall, NIH had their version, then Craig Venter had his version, and they, you know, both competed to see who could come out first to, in a sense, be able to codify the human genome. That was really the start, because the whole enterprise of getting to that endpoint really meant that you had a tremendous collaboration across an incredibly diverse range of different kinds of sciences, many different areas of biochemistry, human physiology, all the whole recombinant proteomics world, you know, got brought into this picture. And because of that, the pressure or the catalyst to propel computing to an extremely more challenging kind of frontier, all these things got brought together into a sort of a continuum, an operational platform of sorts. So from that beginning edge, that provided kind of the support structure, the infrastructure, from which this kind of approach could eventually be taken. And in fact, Craig Venter is exactly doing this now. He is one of the artificial organism sort of developers. But that kind of laid the groundwork to say, well, okay, now that we can isolate and codify and characterize specific genomes, specific genetic components that make up, that are the instructions to, in a sense, like the software, to instruct the cells and the organelles within the cells what to do and how to operate in certain ways, now we can actually begin to dig into the biophysics of those intracellular components, often referred to as organelles. And the science began to really, in earnest, get into the enterprise of opening up these organelles and understanding what makes them tick inside. And these are extremely complicated little bits of machinery, often referred to as mechanochemistry components. And understanding how those mechanochemistry systems work, that was the progenitor that said, well, wait a second, now if we can begin to break these things apart and understand what they do, maybe we can begin to simulate them and model them. And so in that context, a kind of computing science was born called in silico biology, and I think one of the slides points to that. And that allowed people to theoretically model the behaviors and, much more importantly, to map up the schematics, the chemical schematics of how these very complex systems work. And by being able to do that, that in turn could work hand-in-hand with the actual physical, sort of the nanotechnology, if you will, of being able to operate at these sort of molecular level and actually witness and watch and, in a sense, kind of tinker with these molecular systems and then compare those to the models and vice versa. So that whole combination led to the enterprise of being able to essentially build these things from scratch. Now, initially, of course, it was really accomplished by breaking apart these subcellular systems and then sort of recombining them. But that led to the ability to, in fact, create these things from scratch. So we are at that threshold as we speak.
Mankind, for thousands of years, has gone without synthetic biology. Why is it so important now?
A great question. And I'm very glad you asked that. And here's the real reason. We are, and it's interesting because your previous guest was talking about climate change,
yes,
and whether it's going cold or warm. And, you know, that could be a debate, and I'm not a climatologist, so I certainly don't want to debate that topic. But I will say this much, and I can verify this absolutely. The planetary resource base is being challenged, in a way it's never been challenged before, in terms of access to fresh water, arable land, food, energy. Pick any number of different vectors that you could plot this out by. And then if you combine all these vectors and look for a sort of a global assessment over, you know, certain major regions, we have a series of challenges that we simply have never been confronted with before, at least in the history that we currently know of. So we have to come up with solutions or at least alternative options, because the traditional ways of dealing with these problems simply is not going to work in this current time frame. So in that kind of a context, we have a new kind of toolbox to look at. And that toolbox, or at least one of the toolboxes, is this enterprise of synthetic biology. And in fact, let me make a reference that might be a way to bring it home. I noticed that on your website you have a support for children to help, difficult...
Oh, my children, Children International.
It's a great cause, and I totally support this. And the reason I bring it up is because in many of these situations, you know, South America, Africa, parts of Asia, all over the world actually, you have desperate situations where you have, you know, horrible diseases, a lot of biotoxins in the water, in the soil. I mean, really difficult things, and it does especially affects children. And the problem here is that traditionally, to create drugs or other compounds that could, change this or make this situation better, the commitment to produce these things and to manufacture them and distribute them to these parts of the world is very expensive. It's a very complex process. People who are not familiar, the average cost to bring a drug to market is something like around $700 million to maybe $1 billion. That's a big price tag.
No wonder it costs so much.
Well, it's very complex. And if you've ever been to an actual pharmaceutical manufacturing facility, which I have on a number of patients, this is really pushing the extreme outer envelope of, you know, sort of high tech brought to a sort of a mass production kind of environment. Now, compare that, if you will, to what if you could actually just create an organism, maybe a microbe, like a small bacteria, that could, in a sense, do the same thing that a pharmaceutical plant does, but at a remarkable fraction of the cost.
Well, hold on now, Charles. How do we know the pharmaceutical companies would like to do that?
Actually, there are some that are doing this now. In fact, there are patents being written for this. So,
I mean, are the big boys doing it, or smaller venture capital-funded companies?
Well, that's a very good question, because we're actually witnessing, as we speak, and this is one of the reasons I want to go on the air, because we are seeing a kind of a changing of the guard, sort of, and I want to be very cautious here. But in traditional sort of ways you measure this, you're right, it's a very small handful of top 6 or 8 big pharmaceutical companies in the world that sort of control the sort of not just the physics or the chemistry involved, but also the politics and all the, you know, policy directors and everything, how they get drugs produced. Now, all of a sudden, you have this different kind of toolbox appearing on the horizon, which means that even small countries, maybe, you know, Vietnam or Laos or, you know, India or, you know, mid-sized countries, all different countries around the world, can take a completely different approach to how they want to address their individual needs or how they best see to, you know, accommodate the requirements of their populations. This is kind of a power shift of sorts, and it may be drifting off topic just a little bit, but you are right in bringing that topic up, because you are, in fact, seeing a different kind of territory here, where relatively small startup companies or, you know, a small consortium,
sure,
maybe academic and private ventures can sort of, you know, combine forces to approach a problem that could only have been approached with a very big, top-heavy, big bureaucratic / you know, industrial kind of approach. It does change that territory.
Because, you know, when we see the price of drugs, for example, the same drugs dramatically change in price in Canada compared to the United States or in Mexico, there's something wrong going
there's
on.
There's something
here.
Grievously wrong. And I don't want to spend 3 hours, you know, sort of diving into the
pharmaceutical
business. But it is a point to be considered. And I think that it's reasonable and certainly appropriate to maybe re-examine this whole sort of territory, especially when these new kinds of tools could be on the horizon. That's the whole point.
Now, this synthetic biology that's out there, who's teaching this in the universities? I mean, how are we learning this?
Well, I'll start by saying this. I've been asked this question a zillion times, and so I'll go ahead and blurt it out in the air. Lots of kids in high schools, you know, college-age kids and so on, looking for a career path. I would say if you're kind of at a midpoint deciding where to select your majors or what kind of career path, I would be looking at biosciences. I say that with great sincerity here, because that is really where the growth is going to be. And I think this is exactly the kind of stuff that's going to be populating a lot of these new companies in areas where it hasn't really been done before. But just about every major university you can think of, I mean, right here at UC Berkeley, we have a very prolific group of folks working on this. I might back up a square and say that the first actual official announcement.
Yeah, by the way, you're clicking your phone or something.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
okay,
I don't know what you're doing. Do you have a ring on or something?
No, not at all. I will try my best to stay as put as possible. I was trying to type in the computer, but I'll just stay put.
Okay.
Sorry about that. The first sort of official release, or I guess public acknowledgement, really came out of a Canada, University of British Columbia, a person named Robert Holt, who's very well known for this kind of work. And this was back in December 2005, and they were the first to sort of publicly publish papers that, yes, we have an artificial organism in a dish, as it were. But very shortly thereafter, many other schools, big schools, all around the world, actually, Japan is sort of like the other big competitor in this area, they all began publishing their papers and saying, oh, yes, well, we have something similar. You know, so, I mean, it went from, like, zero, essentially, to, like, lots of places. In fact, there's over 100 laboratories now which are publicly acknowledging their work in this area.
Is it like nanotechnology?
Yes, it exactly is. In fact, the last time I was on your show, we talked about this a little bit, and I kind of hinted that nanotechnology comes in many different flavors, and there's all kinds of work going on, but the area where it's really going to sort of burst forth and have a dramatic change in daily life would be in the biological sector. That's exactly what we're seeing now.
Is this going to save lives, in your opinion, Charles? Is it going to prolong life, give us a better life?
That's one of the hopes. That's one of the theories, and that can be debated. And again, that kind of goes back into sort of socioeconomic questions, because after all, if suddenly we can cure lots of diseases and make people live longer, possibly 150 years old and that kind of thing, how does that affect things like Social Security, insurance, the length of one's job life, that kind of thing? These are very complex questions, and each country, each sort of civilization sector, you know, population sector, kind of has to sort out what is the best policy for them. This is just the kind of stuff we wrestle with at the Institute, by the way. And there is no exact one answer. I think it's certainly an answer that has to be sorted out in different cultural areas.
See, I think the future will have a double problem, and that will be there'll be one camp of people like the synthetic biologists who want to preserve life, extend life, develop a better quality of life.
Yeah.
And then you're going to have another camp that wants to eliminate life.
Oh, yes. And I know that, I think you're referring to, there was a famous incident, I think it was the University of North Texas, where an Indian fellow, I can't remember his name now, he came out with a public statement saying, if we want to keep the world in equilibrium and preserve resources and management and so on, we have to cut back the population by 80% or something radical. It was kind of dramatic. A bizarre statement, but I should point out, he was not alone by any stretch.
Well, we've always heard that the globalists want to reduce the population of the planet by billions, that they would be happy with a planet of 500 million people. That would be in total conflict with what the synthetic biologists, let's say, would like to do.
And I, you know, this may be tapping to even, say, theological areas of thought, which I'm maybe not qualified to speculate on. But, yes, that is very much so kind of a conflict.
Who wins, Charles?
I'll put it this way. I'm not claiming to be a paragon of wisdom, but I'll offer kind of my sort of two cents worth at this juncture, and I'll say this much. We have, in my opinion, and many of my colleagues, I think, would be kind of more or less in agreement, plus or minus a couple, 3 years, but I think we have roughly about a decade to kind of sort out these kinds of questions. That is, if we can come to a point of equilibrium where we can have family planning, resource management in a much more homogenous kind of way, and with all the economic difficulties and challenges and conflicts, I know this seems impossible, and, you know, that could be a separate question, but let's just say theoretically in a sort of Pollyannish vision that could be done. We have about a decade or so to kind of come to that sort of plateau where we agree that we're going to keep the population within a certain range and kind of cooperate on an international basis how we deal with resource management and so on. If we don't, I would submit to you that the system will correct itself. That's the nature of evolutionary systems.
And we just don't know which way it'll correct itself.
Well, it could be biological.
Sure.
In fact, that's probably where I think it probably would happen. I think you're going to have a dramatic upsurge in, you know, very horrific epidemics, different kinds of diseases, which, in fact, were in remission are now suddenly making a big comeback. In fact, there was a very good book written about this called The Coming Plague, written by Laurie Garrett, and this came out a handful of years ago. But she was a little bit ahead of her time, but she kind of made a pretty good point. Her thesis was very well established and very well verified in terms of references. But the basic concept was, if you look at the ever more rapidly changing population centers of the world, in other words, people are migrating around, huge population centers are growing, you know, 10, 15, 20 million people in one spot, that kind of thing. Whole chunks of continents are being terraformed, where there used to be forests, there's now open land or even deserts. And, you know, I mean, it's a really radical series of changes that are going on. These kinds of changes happen to also cause very interesting, maybe subtle, but very significant climatic changes. Not in a way that you or I would notice in terms of, gee, it's a bit warmer or colder, but it causes tremendous changes in things like soil chemistry, rainfall patterns, moisture levels, and pH factors in the soil, all kinds of things. And suddenly different kinds of microbes and even viruses that may have been confined to a specific range of host organisms that they would flourish on and so on, they suddenly mutate and they hop over to other organisms. And diseases that were kind of within check suddenly proliferate in a really dramatic way, insects as well. I mean, we see all kinds of strange things going on, insect populations throughout the world, and just things that are happening that normally wouldn't happen, but they've been accelerated by these radical changes we've inflicted upon the planetary climate system.
Charles, stay with us. We'll do your slides next hour. I want to talk about global futures. That's a fascinating topic as we get into synthetic biology. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Those of you who may be visually impaired or you merely just like to listen to your books, I do want to tell you that our book, Worker in the Light, is available on audio, a series of CDs. So you can probably find that at the most major bookstores, the Barnes & Noble, the Borders. But the book is also available at Walmart, Costco, Target, It's all over the place. And, of course, Amazon.com. So those of you who want the book, that's where you can get it. But also the audio book is available. I do know that Amazon has the audio book version available as well. Worker in the Light. Also, let me tell you about the After Dark newsletter, where you get 14 issues for the price of 12. It's a great deal. Call 1-888-727-5505 or go online at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Charles Ospin. Charles, let's talk a little bit about global futures and your role here, and then the next hour we'll kick it into high gear here with the slides and the rest of synthetic biology.
Sure.
Global futures, I mean, that issue has always fascinated me. What are some of the things you do?
Well, we often construct what are called future maps, and I want to point out this is an organization founded by Dr. James Canton, who really is kind of one of the real pioneers in this general concept. And in fact, it was at the Institute that we formulated some of the original position papers, which helped to formulate the policy for the National Nanotechnology Initiative. So in a sense, we had the opportunity, amongst some other groups, to use this kind of a technique to, in a sense, establish the policy that's, in fact, putting some of these sciences into the field now. But the basic concept is this. We look at a very broad spectrum of market forces, economic trends, sociopolitical and cultural influences. We measure also unforeseeable things like terrorism and, you know, dramatic weather changes. I mean, it's actually a very broad spectrum of different variables. And we assign probability factors or percentage of influence numerics to these different variables.
Now, how do you get the probability factor?
That would be a bit of a lecture, but I'll sort of try to summarize if I can. It takes a lot of background. You have to really look at each particular cultural sector or each, you know, sort of like by continent, by section within the continent, that sort of thing. It takes a lot of background in as much of the politics, actually, as it does in the actual sort of physics, if you will, of the circumstance in question. And, of course, we have to look at currency systems because currency is the sort of lifeblood, if I can use that term, that keeps the organism of these various countries functioning in this, and in fact establishes the sort of market health of these different conglomerates of countries and their associates, their trading partners. And the thing that's so interesting is that in recent times, the pace or rate of change and the scale of change, again, these are all accelerating vectors. If you go backwards in time and look at more traditional socioeconomic models and sort of the pace of influence and how different market transitions would change the implementation of technology, you know, all those kind of things. You can measure those things in terms of years, decades, and that kind of thing. Now, because of the internet, because of this global virtual economic system, I actually wrote a series of papers and I talked about something called VCA, or virtual commodity assets. We look at a realm now where the epicenter of value is not based on hard currency or hard assets of any kind. It's based really on the implied potential value of something that's entirely virtual. Just to step back a little bit, I believe the number is something like around 94-95% of the world's currencies are in fact electronic. They're not in any kind of physical form at all. And if you look at the actual trading indices and the different sort of processes that determine market dynamics and all the different components of what's commonly called the value chain, where you supply different kinds of commodities that make different industries possible, these things are all happening in real time. I mean, minute by minute, second by second. This is completely different than what it was, say, 25 or 30 years ago.
Oh, dramatically different.
Dramatically different. And then you throw into the mix an entirely different brew of countries, nation states, even like the whole definition of sovereignty is very much changing, as I'm sure you've talked about in your show in the past. So again, that completely changes the nature as to how these kinds of system dynamics can be measured. So it makes the business of futurism quite a bit different than what it might have been, 25 or 30 years ago. But that is exactly what we're hoping to do. And in fact, we often use a lot of computer modeling and so forth to kind of come up with different sort of alternative variable sets. And then out of that, we try to pick the best choice, as it were, and make a sort of a template out of that.
Who uses the information, Charles?
Everybody. We have corporate clients. We have government agencies, some of which I'm probably not supposed to name.
Well, I understand.
And we have a lot of NGOs, non-government organizations, often from abroad, and they will come to us and say, we have a situation, or we have a reason to plot out a future map based on these criteria. You know, can you do this? And we'll charge them some money, and for a certain amount of time, we'll release a report or kind of, you know, provide a series of data points that they can work with in that context.
How accurate are these models?
Well, in a perfect world, they can be pretty accurate. However, when you throw in elements like terrorism or sudden economic influences caused by an unforeseen disaster, like Katrina is a good example, you know, things of that nature, it makes it for a much more dynamic and, you know, people talk about chaos theory and that kind of thing. And we actually apply a bit of chaos theory because we are looking at a chaotic system.
I mean, do you do a future study about the possibility of some kind of a nuclear war?
Oh, yes. Very much so.
So what's coming up in that arena?
I will give you my personal assessment and my assessment based on the best information that I've had privilege to look at, and I think this would probably bode pretty well with some of the colleagues I work with. I think right now a lot of people are worried about North Korea. I'm not so worried about them. They're kind of like a little island by themselves. They're sort of like a proxy engine for China, and that's a separate little picture we can look at later. I'm really worried, though, about the current situation in Iran, and I'm extremely worried about Pakistan, which is hanging out. I mean, the situation there is very fragile. The minute the current, you know,
regime
gets deposed, which I think could happen any day, you're going to see a dramatic change of events. You're going to see Pakistan and Iran become sort of a united cabal of sorts. They will have their motives in mind, and they will try to implement as much chaos as they can to sort of change the world dynamic in their vision. Not that they'll be successful, but they can create an awful lot of trouble in the constant doing so. I think what we have to worry about here, and if you want to talk nuclear, I'm extremely worried about nuclear devices being brought in by ship or perhaps by rail. I think that's where we really have not been up to speed with knowing how to really monitor these things. And we could change this tomorrow. And I'm astonished. You know, people talk about this all the time, but, you know, not to get too political, but I mean, if we're going to be in Iraq, the theory being to make a kind of a quasi-democratic nation and perhaps establish a point that we can then influence the rest of the region with. Okay, I can kind of, I'm not saying I support it exactly, but I can sort of see the reasoning there. But if we're going to go through all that but not be looking at our own border security and looking at the real potential of some nuclear event happening here, to me, I have trouble seeing the logic of this. It's a really hard model to try to understand because I frankly don't understand it myself. But I think that's where the problem would start.
Over the last couple of days, I've interviewed a Pakistani journalist who claims that there is a terrorist who has made his way into this country from Mexico and has some kind of nuclear bomb or material, and that he's already here. And it's as if, and according to, someone who knows him well, he's never been approached by anybody in government to ask him what he knows. There's something strange going on
here,
Charles.
Something kind of fishy. I'm not really, you know, a big conspiracy sort of guy, but I will freely admit, as one who spends a lot of time looking at this exact kind of scenario mapping and looking at variables and all the different outcomes, so like war games in a way, sort of like economic war games, or that's kind of our focus, but we have a very strong sort of defense aspect woven into that. I just find this very strange. I look for logic and I find big holes in the logic, but that's, you know, I'm not sure I can give a precise answer because I'm not sure there is one given the data we have to work with.
I mean, if you knew your family was in danger, you know, you would take the precautions and the steps necessary to help them and preserve them.
Absolutely.
And I don't see this happening here. I mean, the borders are open, and, not to digress into this area, but it affects what you do for global futures.
Absolutely, because we have to predict in some kind of reasonable fashion all the potential influences that could dramatically change our position in the world economy or the rest of the world's economic stability. And all it would take would be one or two nuclear events, or suddenly Pakistan does fall and suddenly Iran and Pakistan decide to team up and do something crazy. And what's behind that, of course, is Russia is going to be driven to a point where they're going to have to decide what to do. They're kind of playing it cool right now. They've got very substantial commitments with Iran. They're a major trading partner. They've been buying a lot of their weaponry, for instance.
As is China.
I was going to mention China. They're kind of like next in line with this whole scenario. And the thing is, and China, of course, owns the majority of our debt. I mean, just to give a kind of perspective on this, our debt service to China, or vice versa, I'm sorry, is about $2 billion a day. Now, think about this for a minute. We're talking a debt leveraging in the trillions of dollars. This is the first time in history that a major nation state, such as us, has been fighting an entire war, an entire sort of foreign front, as it were, financed by a foreign country.
I know. I mean, it's almost like we're doing this on a major credit card.
We're talking credit card on steroids cubed. I mean, there's no precedent for this. So when people come to us and say, okay, model this out, we have to say, well, this is a weird model. This is not according to traditional economic rules or what would even be logically reasonable. And so, it's a really strange territory to try to operate in. And I mean, a couple of quick thoughts, if you want to walk down this path a little bit.
Sure.
I think at a certain boundary point, if the pressure really was on, let's say, God forbid, Israel was hit with a nuclear device, I think that's certainly a possibility, or we got hit with a nuclear device, or maybe both at the same time. You know, something comes into a port and blows up, and then Israel gets hit or something.
Yes.
Okay, great. Russia at that point is going to have to decide real quick what they're going to do. Whose side are they on? Now, of course, they have their own internal problems with Chechnya and some other Muslim populations. I'm sure that they're extremely keenly, you know, they have their own difficulties. It's not like they're just sitting there quietly. You know, Putin's got a real can of worms on his hands.
Yeah, but in our case, who in the heck do you hit? Who do you strike back at?
That's the $64 trillion question. That's an extremely difficult thing to figure out. And if we strike it at any of the major Muslim nations that we would tend to suspect or hold up as a potential target, you can almost automatically assume where that's going to lead. And so what is the response? Now, there have been some discussions as to potential response variables, and I'm not sure I should go about that, you know, on the public airwaves.
But, No. But, you opened it up. Go ahead. Tell us.
People are digesting this concept, and I think that in the current administration, I'm not sure they would know what to do, but I'm not sure anyone would know what to do. I mean, I think we would...
You mean they don't have a plan yet?
Not anything that I'm aware of. Not a cohesive... I mean, of course...
That's as scary as the possibility of the event.
Yeah, well, thank you. That was my point. I mean, it really is a squirrely, strange world. And what I'm particularly bent on is, having digested a lot of the 9/11 materials over the past couple of years, the one thing I come away with is that you have these really separate little pockets of little groups of people who were very, very on top of certain aspects of the 9/11 situation, but nobody was really sort of with an overview, coherently tying it all together
right,
and saying, here's our policy, here's our strategy. I fear, sadly, that we're sort of in the same situation now. I mean, we may have a little more of a quasi-coherent sort of glimpse as to what we might do, but I still think we're in this very patchwork-like sort of jigsaw puzzle with a few pieces missing, sort of attempt to figure out what might be
a
potential response.
You don't think there's anybody dumb enough in this country who would want us to absorb a nuclear hit, do you?
I don't think people in this country, in terms of, you know, our citizens and that kind of thing.
No, I know about the citizens. I'm not talking about them.
I would suspect that there could easily be people from elsewhere in the world who may well have already gotten themselves here, and they're waiting for their instructions to say, okay, do it now. I mean, that's a real
possibility. Oh, no, I mean government. Do you think there's...
Oh, I don't, George, that's probably outside my territory. I would agree.
Because I would hope not.
No, to carry off a conspiracy of that scale would be fantastic beyond anything you could describe. However, there might be certain people who are sympathetic because they have their own personal interest in agendas, exactly. So they might kind of quietly allow for something to happen. I mean, I could sort of see that maybe. That's a sort of a halfway answer, but that I might be willing to go that far.
Okay, let's do a global futures model scenario here for a moment, Charles.
Sure.
Okay, we get, because I've been talking to people who believe it's going to happen.
Well, I think it's a pretty, I'd say 80% chance, yeah.
Well, God, that's pretty scary. That's high.
Yeah,
I wanted you to say 20%, not 80.
I would say there's an 80% chance that something's going to be tried. Now, if
all
we're
right.
lucky and we can put the clamp on it just before it happens, God help us all. I hope that's the way it works. But I think it's an 80% chance that there's something already in the works.
Okay.
I would go that far.
What does the model say if something happens? What's the retaliation? What do we do?
Again, you know, it's funny you bring this up because I think I don't even watch TV anymore. I don't have time. But apparently there's some TV show called Jericho, which is about this exact thing where a nuclear bomb goes off in Kansas or something. I mean, I think it's kind of interesting that the public audience is sort of being prepped or trained or sort of, I don't know, made to warm, you know, just sort of become used to the concept because that's...
Or the possibility.
Or the possibility, yeah, exactly. I mean, I find that kind of frightening because I think that when we were on the air back in the Katrina moment, We talked about this film that was on, the talking about the oil storm, whatever it was called.
Right, right.
And we were remarking to how similar it was, that the Katrina thing sort of like was the exact model of what was on the television show.
And then bang.
And now, yeah, you know, so again, I'm not trying to get too conspiratorial, but I do look at these things and go, it's interesting. As far as picking a specific target to go after, I think what the plan might be, and I'm just speculating based on some information that may or may not be really accurate, but what I can see, we'll pick a target of opportunity that best serves a larger agenda, even if they're not the actual target that made the thing happen. That's kind of how I see it. That's kind of, that sounds a little bizarre, but...
You mean they would or we would?
No, we would.
We would.
So. Yeah, in other words, we went into Iraq not because we believed they were involved in 9/11. That's ridiculous.
Well, and it's been shown they weren't.
It's been shown that many times over. And I think the weapons of mass destruction, there may have been something there, but nothing remotely approaching what they were trying to sell us. So, I mean, the Iraq thing was well established way before, long before 9/11 even happened. I mean, if you look at the PNAC documents and so on, you kind of get a picture of that. Okay, so they had this in mind. They knew what they wanted to do. 9/11 kind of served a convenient moment to kind of make this come into action.
Mm-hmm.
If there was a nuclear event or something, or let's say a horrible biological event, which I think is certainly an equal possibility,
true,
we would then say, okay, it's Iran, let's go after them. You know, I'm not saying that's what we would do, but it looks kind of like that, like they would be looking for the next moment of catalyst.
So they want an excuse in order to do something.
And again, this is just my opinion. I'm not saying I have proof of this, but, you know, there are some bits and pieces that kind of look this way.
Well, Charles, you know what? That is as scary as the possibilities of a detonation.
It's serious stuff. And, you know, I get up every morning and thank God. And I have a spiritual belief in my own. And I thank who's ever out there. We have sunlight. There's a planet still here. Thank you. And I'm happy to try to do my best I can in my little world to do something of good nature. But there are those moments when you get frustrated and think, well, you know, if it's going to be something of this level of, you know, cataclysm, you know, you kind of get to a certain point where you kind of get frustrated at points. But I try to stay in a positive frame of mind and just try to focus on the things that I can work with and that I do know about.
I'm a logical thinker
like you are. Sure, sure.
And I sit back and I look at, okay, we've got very porous borders.
Yep, I agree.
We're hearing things of some kind of calamity is about to... ready to occur.
I
don't see or hear anybody addressing this on a government level. I mean,
it is kind of scary, and I'll give you a little bit of insight.
It's almost as if somebody somewhere wants something to happen, wants to let it happen in order for us to then do some of the things you just mentioned.
I'll give you one small data point, and I'll just let the audience and yourself kind of decide how you want to read this. But this I personally witnessed, so it's something I can testify to personally. I was at a big biotech conference three years ago.
Let's hold it to the top. We're already at the top.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay?
All right, fair enough.
So you tell us about what you heard at this bio conference. I mean, this is scary stuff, folks. This is scarier than synthetic biology, which we will talk about.
Hopefully so.
Charles, your websites, which ones do you want us to go to?
Oh, certainly. Two of them I'd like to mention. Historian of the Future, that's my website, and then also something called the Global Clean Tech Network. It's a really excellent group of folks. Our whole bent is to kind of create awareness and investment in sustainable technologies, and we're having a conference on November 17, which I certainly welcome anybody who's interested here in Palo Alto, California, to attend or, you know, maybe have a look at. And both those sites are on the Coast to Coast website now.
This show has gone from one of those moments where you almost like fall out of your bed going, what did he say? That's the kind of night we've got right now. Stick with us. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM.